But how is one to do this? How is one to transform the present world into a spiritual community? How is one even to begin? Now, before I go into this, I must deal with a possible objection, or at least must make certain things clear. There are quite a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the world in one way and another, for one reason or another. Dissatisfied with the way things are. There are quite a lot of people who would like to change them. Whether their dissatisfaction with the way things are is always deep enough, I don't propose to inquire this evening. But they differ among themselves as regards the way in which things can be changed. Broadly speaking, we may say, there are two views. The first view says, we must change the system. The first view says, people are all right, basically. That is to say, all right as they are. It's simply that they're unlucky enough to live under the wrong system, under a bad system, even to be oppressed by that system. So one must change the system, replace the wrong system by the right system, and we shall then have a new world, a world in which everybody will be happy. That's one view. And the other view is that one must change the individual. And here the individual is used in the popular sense, not in the sense in which I've been using it in these lectures. The individual, it is said, by people holding this view, is greedy, is selfish, is stupid. And all the troubles of the world are due to this simple fact. There are wars between groups of people, between nations even, because people are not free from hatred. And there are economic crises in the world because people, at least some people, are not free from greed. And therefore, if we want to change the world, we must change ourselves. We must become different, must become contented, unselfish, generous, wise, and there's no other way. Sometimes this point of view is put very forcibly indeed as a sort of moral appeal. The first view, that we must change the system, is generally regarded as the secular view, not to say the materialistic view. And the second, that we must change ourselves, is generally regarded as the spiritual view. Personally, I can't agree with either view completely. In fact, they are not really mutually exclusive. Spiritual movements, especially those of Eastern origin, those which trace their descent from the wisdom of the East, are generally expected to adopt the second view, that is to say, the spiritual view, the view that we must change ourselves, improve ourselves, and then everything will be all right. The world almost automatically will be a better and a happier place. But the FWBO does not share this view, this so-called spiritual view. In the FWBO, we certainly are concerned with the development of the individual. We regard this as absolutely crucial, absolutely fundamental, even where the question of transforming the world into a spiritual community is concerned. But at the same time, we do recognize that external conditions can and do help or hinder. If we live under the right system, it is easier to develop. And if we live under the wrong system, it is more difficult. Not, of course, that if one lives under the right system, one will develop automatically. One will still have to make the effort, must still want to develop. And some people, of course, we may say, are more dependent on external conditions than others. Or, in other words, some are more truly individuals than others. Some will develop, however unfavourable external conditions may be, will develop despite all obstacles, will find a way, will make a way, will push their way through. But others will not be able to develop, perhaps, even if conditions are highly favourable. Others, in some cases, may even refuse to develop. In the case of the vast majority of people, we may say that external conditions are quite important and do make quite a lot of difference. If we get the right conditions, almost certainly we will develop. And if we don't get the right conditions, probably we will not. So conditions are important. We see this very clearly in the matter of our retreats. After all, what is a retreat? What happens when we have a retreat? Well, what happens is that we simply take a group of people, sometimes 10, sometimes 15, 20, even 40, 50, 60, away into the country. And what do? We put them down in a quiet, pleasant place in the midst of beautiful natural surroundings. And we keep them there for a week, or a fortnight, or in some cases for 3 weeks, or even a month. We keep them there. And what do? I mean, what do we give them to do? Well, to begin with, they don't have to do any work. Apart, perhaps, from a little cooking, turn by turn, a little washing up, a little gardening, one or two odd jobs, and so on. That's all. That's all the work that they do. And what else do? They meditate 2 or 3 or 4 times a day in relatively short sessions. They chant. They participate in the puja. They listen to lectures. They have discussions. And maybe they do the communication exercises. In other words, for a longer or shorter period, we change the conditions under which people live. We give them better conditions, conditions more conducive to personal development, even ideal conditions. And when we do that, when we take them away on retreat, when we give them those conditions, what do we find happens? We find that people change. We see this actually happening before our eyes, day by day. And sometimes people change quite dramatically, even after just a few days. And how do they change? You find them becoming more relaxed. They might have arrived on the retreat all worried, harried, hassled, anxious, tired, negative, but they become more relaxed and they become more emotionally positive. They cheer up, they actually laugh and smile and seem glad to be alive, and they become more sensitive, more aware of themselves, of one another, of their surroundings, of nature. More aware of the fact that they're alive, that they're living and breathing on this earth. And they become likewise more free and more spontaneous, more themselves. And I've seen this, and many of you have seen this happen many and many a time. And though we've seen it happen many and many a time, each time the change seems almost magical. But unfortunately, the retreat has to come to an end, and people have to go back to to wherever it is that they came from. I remember in the very early days when we had our first retreats and when people had their first taste of these better, these more ideal conditions. At the end of the retreat, when it was time to leave, time to go home, they'd stand in little clusters at the gates, just not wanting to go. And some of them would be shedding tears, just not wanting to go, because usually they had to go back to less helpful conditions. So because one has to go back, maybe back to the boring job, back to the noisy, crowded city, back perhaps to the unharmonious domestic surroundings, the change does not always last. But nevertheless, there's one lasting benefit. One has learned one thing at least, which one rarely, if ever, forgets, and that is that it is possible to change. That, given the right conditions, one can develop, and develop more easily, provided, of course, that one makes the effort. Now, a few minutes ago I said that in offering a blueprint for a new world, the FWBO was offering something that does not exist. But it would now appear that that is not strictly true. Because when we're on retreat, we experience, at least to a slight extent, and for a short time, what the new world will be like, what the new world could be like. We might even go so far as to say that the retreat is the new world on a very small scale and for a very short time. But nonetheless, it does show us what is possible. It shows us that the new world need not exist only in the imagination, that it need not be only a dream. Shows us that the world could be transformed into a spiritual community,